Swiss Army Nation, welcome to your podcast. This show is about you, your passion, and your experiences. Join us for panel discussions, interviews, fan profiles, and so much more. When the curtain drops, the excitement begins. So let's go. Hello, my friends, and welcome to episode 136 of the Kiss Army Nation podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Pasquale Vary.
And I am Claudio Spera. Welcome to the show, everyone. Known as the man behind the dark glasses and blue sea guitar hooks, our guest tonight has captivated audiences worldwide with crashing riffs and swagger. So Bernie in Huntington Beach, California, he has all the possible check marks of a true rock star. Founder of Great White, one of the most successful bands born on the Sunset Strip during the early 80s, forging numerous hits over the years, we are truly honored to have Mark Kendall in the house with us tonight. So welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you. I can't find my shades.
You still look cool, my friend. You still look cool.
Always.
Thank you.
So, Mark, we've interviewed, you know, a lot of musicians on the show, and it's really incredible. You know, they have that, like you, that rock star status, but they started off like everybody else, like you and me, you know? So how did your passion for music start?
Actually, at a pretty early age, my parents, my dad was a musician and my mom sang. The kind of music they listened to was more jazz orientated, but they did have, you know, so I remember sitting next to the record player listening to The Girl from Ipanema and stuff like that. And I caught on to the melody right away and actually was singing in key. My mom told my dad one day, I was only like 6 years old, and she's going, he's singing in key, you know. So I kind of inherited their ear, I guess through DNA or something. Like I heard music good and I could replicate what I was hearing, and it was in tune. Which is a good sign, because you know they say I couldn't carry a tune in a bucket, you know. I think some people that don't have that, they hear the music well but they can't
reproduce it.
You know they can't duplicate it, to where I was able to have that melody in my head at, like I said, at a young age. So, and I love music, you know, I used to sing along to records, sing. I only, for some reason, even when I started playing guitar at 9 years old, was the first guitar I got. I wasn't listening to the guitar. I was listening to the singer, even with like Hendrix. Like I would sing along with Hendrix, sing along with Cream, sing along with The Doors. I was just fascinated by the melody and the song, you know, more than guitar flash or anything like that.
Right.
Very cool. Very cool.
You know, it is always so fascinating, Mark, when we have the chance to have a conversation with someone like you who has been surrounded by music, you know, at such an early age. This is a gift. So I have a couple of questions for you. Sure. So you mentioned some of those, you know, in the previous question with Pask, but what were some of your major musical influences in the blues and the rock world?
Well, when I first started playing, you know, just learning my way around the neck, the kind of songs that were out, I was learning the easiest ones, like Gloria, Pipeline, Wipeout, Secret Agent Man, you know. But as I started to grow, like I said, my first three records were Cream, The Doors, and Hendrix. So I could definitely say that influenced me as far as the melody and all that, you know, as a boy. I was a little boy. But as I grew and started to learn my way around the neck and became a young teenager, I started to gravitate toward like Carlos Santana, Johnny Winter, and I would be obsessed with them. Like I wanted to change my name to Carlos at one point.
Oh, really?
I mean, when I saw him play on the Woodstock video, he grabbed a note and he was like, it was like for dear life or something. And for some reason that resonated with me and it made me want to play with a lot of feel and it made me want to improve, get better on guitar and inspired me to practice a lot and try to get better. But I had many influences, I loved Alvin Lee. To this day, I love Billy Gibbons.
Mm-hmm.
I loved Stevie Ray Vaughan. Most of the guitar players that I love play with a certain amount of passion. Like they're not so much technical, but they're very good with their melody. The way they bend notes, their vibrato, it seems that they feel what they're playing as opposed to something that they got off paper.
Yeah, so it's technical. Like, yeah, right.
That instead of which I appreciate anyone that has technical ability. In fact, I'm blown away by it. But at the same time, I like it when they have
That feel, know, right?
When they really feel it, and it's very obvious when they have that.
Yeah,
you can tell by their body shapes, their facial expressions, that they are totally in this moment. They're feeling this note, and that's what I gravitated towards. As opposed to someone that's just technical that doesn't really have that, but their skills are like incredible.
Yeah, that's right.
I wish I knew that lick.
That's right, exactly. So, speaking of emotions and all of that, so were you into B.B. King and Johnny Winter also? Or
Like Johnny Winter was my hero. Still Alive and Well to this day is one of my favorite records of all time. And one of the things I loved about the record, well, one thing I discovered when I met Johnny Winter, we were going to have him play a slide part on the record. He ended up not doing it because he hates overdubbing. And the song was already recorded. And he said, if you guys want to jam and roll tape, I'll do that, but I'm not going to do an overdub.
Wow.
He goes, Edgar tries to get me to do those overdubs. They always make me do it 40 times and they take the first one. But one thing I discovered, because I didn't understand when I was 15, I'm learning note for note Johnny Winter licks, but it doesn't sound like him. And I didn't understand why, because I'm playing it perfect. When I met him, I realized why. It's because when he was a boy, playing ukulele on TV with his brother, he was using finger picks.
Oh.
So every time he hit a string, it was in the same direction.
Oh.
Get me? He wasn't going up and down.
Okay.
He was going this way only.
Only up.
That creates like a machine effect.
Mm.
So when he plays the notes, it's struck in the same direction, which is very... it doesn't have a bang, gong, gang,
right.
gong type
right,
sound.
Right.
So when I saw him play up close, I realized he took those picks from playing ukulele, and when he grabbed a guitar, he didn't take them off. He still used
He played
it.
The same way.
Yeah. Very unique, because you don't see it a lot, guitar players playing with the thumb pick.
Right.
At least not in rock and roll. We all hold picks like this standard way. So it came from him playing a different instrument. And I think also his coordination from having those picking, like a banjo picker, having all those picking patterns, guitar probably came pretty easy to him,
yeah.
know?
Okay.
And yeah, definitely Mark, a huge influence.
And you know, you said before, coming from such a gifted family, why exactly? Well, I think you mentioned that before, you know, thanks to all the great players that you named. But why did you pick up the guitar? So why guitar? Why not piano? Why not singing? Why not bass?
I can tell you why. It's actually quite the accident, really. I'm loving music. I'm singing along to these records, but I used to watch a band across the street when I was very young. Used to watch them in the garage through this little side window of a door. And one day, I saw the bass player playing with his teeth.
Oh.
Like Hendrix. Oh.
Okay, yeah.
When I saw that, I went racing home and begged my dad to get me a guitar. I go, I got to play, got to get a guitar. So he got me an acoustic guitar. And you know what? There were neighbors that were, you know, it advanced enough to, they could show me chords. So I learned chords from, you know, neighbors and stuff that were older than me, and was able to, you know, put songs together, and, you know, played for my fourth grade class with another guy who had really good equipment. That was when I was 10. I got an electric guitar called the K-A-Y, mm-hmm. and a K amp. The guy that I was jamming with had a Fender Mustang guitar, totally badass, with a Fender Twin Reverb amp. So he had the pro gear, I had the K stuff. But, you know, it was really fun. And then there was a drummer, 20 years old, that was my neighbor, that let me and him jam with him. So mm-hmm. I actually got to play with the drummer, which was awesome. Now, my dad was, you know, an advanced upper echelon jazz trumpet player.
Okay.
When I was 15, I was getting pretty good on guitar. And he came to me one day and he goes, play something. But he put a metronome up, one of those clicking type ones.
Yeah.
And said, play something while it's going click, 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 click. I go, well, I don't know what to play. He goes, play anything. Just play. And I played and I was playing in rhythm.
Okay.
And he goes, you just might do okay.
You might just do okay.
Had I not played at that metronome, I don't know what he would have said. He would have probably broke my heart. Broke my heart or something.
That was the green
you
light.
Got no chance, kid. You got no rhythm. You got no chin.
You got the green light. That's awesome.
Yeah. Boy, and your dad couldn't be more right. You know, Great White, for example, right? So, you know, Great White is without a doubt one of the most successful bands that came out of L.A. in the 80s. So how did that come about for you? How did that happen?
Well, there was a sea of bands, for one thing. It was very healthy music scene. There was a lot of bands. I mean, I saw Van Halen when I was a teenager play at a junkyard real close to my house. And I was playing with some guys, kind of the embryo of even having a singer. I mean, you know, but you know, time went on, you get this guy, you get that guy. And, finally I put the right thing together and, we started playing around and eventually for one thing, we played free a lot because we wanted to try to play as often as possible, mm-hmm. not just a couple times a month. So to kind of put ourselves in a position to maybe get lucky and maybe there'd be somebody in the crowd one day that could help us, mm-hmm. you know, maybe go up a couple notches from where we were at. This was a few years rolled by for this to happen, but then we started playing in Hollywood. And from playing so much together, we started to get better. You know, our songs were improving, you know, our lyrics became a little less corny. You know, and one night we were playing at a club in Hollywood, and there was a guy, an A&R man in the crowd called Alan Niven. And he gave us his card. He said, come down to the record company the following day, which was an independent label. And everything just became a whirlwind after that. And we got some airplay on a demo record we did. It was like a 5-song EP. And we got a song in rotation on the radio through his connections, this Alan Niven A&R man. And he became our manager. And eventually we got a record deal. But we wouldn't, you know how, like when you're in high school and they say, oh, this girl's most likely to, you know, be a runway model or a successful businesswoman, or this guy most likely will be a sports star. Well, we weren't on the most likely list. We were kind of low on the totem pole as far as local bands, you know, the bands that figured to go, you know, get deals and go off and be big rock stars. Some of them didn't, you know. But, you know, I think we worked hard, even though you need a lot of luck, you know, to get an opportunity like we got. But I really feel that we worked really hard. We were just all in, you know, either we're going to be total bums or this is going to go. You know, we didn't sit there and have the attitude like, well, if this doesn't work out, I'm going to go do this.
Right.
You know, because a lot of times, and I understand that, you know, that the chances are very low that you know, something great's going to happen. So you want to have that back burner, you know, something to fall back on.
That's right.
But we didn't do that. We said we are going to be Skid Row bums or this is going to go.
This is all or nothing.
That's
right.
We really had a, and we used to pretend a lot, which sounds corny, but we used to give each other interviews with like cassette players. You know what I mean? And pretend we've got there, you know, like how long has the band been together? You know? And we would answer each other and pretend we were playing the Forum. The funny thing is all these things we pretended were happening ended up happening, which makes it really surreal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we wanted to play the Forum because that's where all the bands played, the Ted Nugents, the, you know, Deep Purple, and all the Kiss, you know, all the big bands that we used to go see as teenagers. So we wanted to play there, and we did. And, you know, in front of our parents, our friends. So I guess if you believe in something, you know, sometimes something might come your way, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No, that's a fantastic attitude to have. You know, it's you're either in or you're out.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about it. Mm-hmm. But while you were in it, did you feel that there was something special about Great White, that something special will come out of this?
Well, when we first started, we kind of got shot down after we did two tours with Whitesnake and Judas Priest. We came home, we were under 100,000 sold.
Mm.
Back in those days, they did what's called artist development. So like if, say, you don't really sell a ton the first time out, they might get a songwriter in, or they might work with you, or, you know, do something so you can get up to 250 or 300,000 on the next try. Well, we didn't get that chance. They just said, you know, we really don't want to do anything else. This ain't happening. So essentially we were kind of dropped off the label.
Mm-hmm.
So we went and didn't give up. We went and made our own record, and we got a marginal hit with a song called Face of Day on the radio, which generated interest in Capitol Records, which is ironic because they were the father company of EMI America who dropped us.
Okay.
So right. It really was very, you know, like, I don't know if stuff like that's supposed to happen, but we didn't give up. We kept fighting on our own and went a whole year with no record deal, just playing around California. But we had established ourselves by those two tours, so it wasn't a loss. It wasn't wasted that we made all this effort and put out a record that didn't, you know, shock the world. It was okay because we did have fans, and as long as we came with something good, we had a chance, you know. And so when we made the album with Rock Me, that was kind of a do or die record, and luckily for us, it caught on and gave us a career.
Mm-hmm.
So if we fast forward in time, you hit the mainstream, if I'm not wrong, in 1987, and when you released, you know, your third album, Once Beaten, with songs like, you know, Rock Me, Save Your Love, and Lady Red Light. So could you walk us through those incredible moments? So what are some of your best memories of those days?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually told the story before, but, well, for one thing, I really didn't know, you know, you when you're the guy at the easel painting your painting, you know what I mean? You kind of have tunnel vision and you don't know what the world's going to think.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, you don't really know if you've done something great yet, right? Mm-hmm. You're not sure if, is this good? It's like you want feedback from your friends and go, what do you think of this thing? You know what I mean? But when you're making it, it's not like when you play live, like 1, 2, 3, 4, play the song and it ends. We're doing this part and then moving over here doing this. And, you know, then it comes all together. And when I felt we'd done something good, it was when the Capitol Record people came down to the studio in the control room and we rolled the album. And I heard Rock Me back all mixed and everything. It sounded really good to me, you know. And I, my thinking was, you know, even though I don't know what people will think, it's like, I think I got pretty good taste in music. This song, mm-hmm. Like, I can sit back away from this and say, and be objective and say, I mean, it sounds great to my ears. It sounds like we put together a great song. I mean, God, I would hope people like it. You know what I mean? But here's the thing, is the song was 7 minutes long. That's what made me nervous.
Oh.
We have never had a hit in our lives, right? And we're going to, you know, put a 7-minute song. It's like you never have a hit and you're going to put out 2112, you know,
exactly.
By Rush.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
You know what I mean? Hey, this song's 43 minutes long.
Yeah,
dig
yeah.
it.
You yeah, know? Yeah, that's right.
It's like, so our manager did the funniest thing, and he did it for a joke, just to see if people would catch on. He put on every song on the record that it was 3 minutes and 59 seconds.
Oh,
so
yeah?
When the radio stations got the single, it said 3:59, but it's 7 minutes.
Nice.
By the time they figured it out, the song, the, you know, lights, the phones were lighting up. The song was a hit. I mean, it was, you know. So, but that made me nervous. The song doesn't seem 7 minutes because there's so many dynamics. It takes you here, and then you're down here, and then you're over here. You know, it's not like if you were flatlining, just playing at one speed, just all right, flatline all the way through, it probably wouldn't work. But because of all the dynamics, it makes it not seem so long mm-hmm. for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And Mark, it's, you know, of course, you know, this is a Kiss podcast. And of course, we want to talk about your connection with the band. And I don't know if I'm right or wrong, because, you know, actually we were discussing with Pask before and we were not even sure. Did you guys tour with Kiss during the Lick It Up tour? Is that correct, or it came later on?
I believe it was 1993. So I think it was Revenge, maybe.
Oh, 93. Okay. After Revenge. Album okay.
called Revenge. Make, mm-hmm. You know, they didn't have makeup. I actually, when I was an up and comer, there was a guitar player and his name was Mark Norton. Mm-hmm. And I was on tour with Judas Priest, and I was at a place called the Limelight, New York. It was like kind of like a dance place. I mean, it's like a disco place, but like rockers go there. Everybody just goes there, you know. And I saw Mark, and I couldn't figure out what the heck is Mark doing in New York. And he's a guitar player, real good one. Was in a band called White Tiger, local band. Mm-hmm. But he's a great guy, really good guitar player. And he was screaming, and there's like 100 people in front of us, and we're screaming at each other because it's so crowded. And I thought he was saying, "I'm on Kiss." And I thought maybe there's a radio station called that, and he was on the radio station or something to do with the radio station. By the time we connected together, he said, "No, dude, I'm in Kiss. I'm playing guitar for Kiss." I go, "Get the hell out of here." He goes, "Yeah, I changed my name to Mark St. John. I'm playing with Kiss. I just did the record." And that album, I think, was called Animal Life.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he played on that record. But he got called, I think it's called tendonitis or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, like some kind of arthritis.
His hand was swollen like crazy. Like, no way could he play guitar. And so he had to heal. It took 4 weeks. And when he went back, they got Bruce Kulick, and they're going to stick with him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That had nothing going on with it, would have changed his whole fate. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
just
yeah.
That hand injury knocked him out of the loop. But in 93, we toured with Kiss. I think it was maybe 2.5 months or so.
Okay.
Really, really enjoyed it. I knew a lot of their crew. From the past and stuff, and it was funny because they had one song where they put a girl in a cage, right? So they would have their crew go to strip clubs and get all these people to come, all these girls to come back, you know, like 17 girls, right? And all strippers, and they would go meet Paul and Gene, and they would pick the one out of 17 that was going to be in the cage that night in this one song, right?
Yeah.
So that left 16 girls backstage. Okay. Get me? In the 80s. Okay.
Thanks, Kiss. Thank you. Thank you.
So you don't even have to go to the strip club. They're here.
I love it.
But I thought that was great. And that was an enjoyable time. As far as history about Kiss, when I was a teenager, I had friends that were the biggest Kiss fans known to man. That's when I first heard of them, you know, Detroit, Rock City, and all that. But when the Kiss Alive album came, there was a way bigger buzz. And I know the record sold millions.
Yeah.
But for some reason, it seemed to be a way bigger deal when their image and the live album, we got to see their images, the music was killer, you know. That's one thing about Kiss, they have great songs.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember some of the bands, you know, because we played covers as up and comers, and there was a lot of bands that played, you know, Kiss cover songs, and you know, they had the whole package, you know. It's something that reaches a ton of age groups, because even kids, you know, the lunch pails, they're like,
true, yeah.
They're superheroes, you know what I mean? And plus they got great music. So I think it's kind of cool, you know, if you're going down the road they did with makeup and stuff, it must take a lot of work, a lot of dedication to have the image it's not just like they show up and play music. I mean, yeah, they do that too, but they also, their image is an important thing. And fans latch on to these guys. It's like Paul Stanley's my favorite guy in the world, man. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they get that going out. Peter Criss, man, you know. It's like, because they each have their image, so people really dig their image and the way they play and, you know, the songs. And so they were individually,
right,
had fans as well as
yeah.
the band as
yeah.
a whole. You know what I mean? Like Gene Simmons, all the stuff he did with his antics on stage with the tongue and the blood and the, you know, it's all cool stuff, man. Influence for a lot of bands that go down
oh,
that
yeah.
road.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But also, like you said earlier, they're not virtuosos. They're not technical players. You could feel their music. The music is just fun, you know? And you could see them
yeah.
having fun on stage when they're playing those songs.
They don't take themselves too serious.
Yeah.
But the songs always had great hooks, you know. It's just easy to figure out. There, you know, when you hear it, you know what you just listened to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see why they went so huge. And I'm sure it took a lot of work, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I said, there's no overnight success stories, believe me. And I've actually watched a lot of documentaries on bands that I'm kind of curious about, you know, even like a Tom Petty or Eagles or any band, Chicago even.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be right in my genre. I want to hear how did this happen? You know, what did this guy do to get from here to here? You
to
know
be
what I mean?
There.
I want to
yeah.
hear what happened.
Yeah.
And you can't believe they didn't quit. You know what I mean? Their stories are such a grind and in such hard work. That's why when I used to hear the phrase overnight success, I'm thinking, wow, really? And like, just guy just grabbed a guitar and he became a rock star or something. I haven't heard one story like that yet.
No.
So
no.
I think that phrase is probably overused.
I guess it feels like it's overnight. Because of them, it happened so quickly, but they don't realize
yeah.
the amount of work that went into it to get them to where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that could be partly of what people mean. You know, when it's overly used, it seems like overnight. You know, I can think, sometimes they leave out it seems though.
Mm-hmm. Right,
overnight success.
Right, right.
Because they only know about what they saw when you started to do well. They don't know about the story before that and
before
all the
that, yeah.
trial
exactly.
and error and failures and, you know, I'm not going to give up yet, man, even though those people said I suck.
Yeah. So speaking of big bombastic shows, you were also part of the Monster of Rock Festival back in 88. And my
yeah.
God, you know, what a lineup. So what was it like for you to play, you know, alongside acts like Iron Maiden, Kiss, Guns N' Roses,
yeah.
David Lee Roth, Megadeth, Anthrax? What was that like for you?
You know, that was great. It was in Schweinfurt, Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know that people know how huge Iron Maiden is, because I knew they were big. Like, they could play an arena here, no problem,
yeah.
or be on a festival package. But they are like, I was at a hotel, and they came out of the hotel, and they had to run to their cars. There were so many fans.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the Beatles. I'm not
mm-hmm.
kidding. They headlined that show you're talking about. Over Kiss and David Lee Roth. But yeah, it was, you know, a teenager's dream, a dream of mine to, you know, play for 200,000 people and go out and have people dig our music and, you know, meet some of our heroes and our bands that we really like a lot. That's one of the benefits. I've met so many people and really learn from them, like with Judas Priest and the Scorpions. They knew, especially Judas Priest, they knew we're green and we're scared to death. You know? I mean, we're coming out of clubs and we're playing in front of, 20,000 people every night. They took us under their wing. They were there before too. So that's really what I took away from Judas Priest, was how to treat people. We've always treated our opening acts great. You know, we want the whole night to be good, just like those guys. And that's the whole thing. They're not intimidated by Great White. You know, they want the opening acts to do well. Mm-hmm. You know, even the Scorpions, they want. I even had Rudolph Schenker going, "Mark, you got to play hard out there. Kick ass, maximum nice. Ass. You know, he told me, you got to treat this like life and death. I mean, you have to play hard, man.
That's nice.
You know, people are coming to see you. You know, you really got to leave it out there. And that really inspired me to hear these things by experienced pros who have been on tour for years, you know. Now I can take some of that and maybe share it with somebody who I think's not doing the best they could.
Exactly, you know? Yeah.
My God, man.
Go for it. That's right.
But that's it, right? You have to play hard for the people that are there to see you, but play even harder for the people that are not there to see you. So you can make an impression on them and have them watch a show that they'll never forget.
That's something my manager told me. He told me one time, he said, you know, almost anybody can entertain someone, but it's more difficult to impress them.
Mm-hmm.
So try to impress people. And that's a different level. Entertaining is like, oh, these guys are great, you know. But impress is like jaw dropped.
That's right.
Can you believe what we just saw? You know, like, God, you know, that's because they put that extra effort in.
Right.
And if you ever notice anybody that's great at anything, it's because they worked harder than the guy that's just really good.
Exactly.
You know what
exactly.
I mean? That's what separates great in anything from really good, because they work a little bit harder than that guy.
Right. But that applies definitely to Great White, because, you know, I could imagine the high, the excitement, the emotional ride of listening to songs like Rock Me, Mr. Bone, Save Your Love, House of Broken Love, live on stage with that energy. So do you believe that Great White's greatness is best experienced live?
Well, yes, because when you record something like that, you have to wait a few months to find out if you're good or not.
Right.
When you play live, they let you know right when the song ends. And I like that immediate feedback. You kind of know if you're doing good. And it makes you want to even play harder. God, they're going crazy now. Wait till they get a load of this next one.
Right.
that's what you're thinking, you know. But live. There's nothing like live. It's I've heard it said like record is if you're comparing it to school, that's like being in class, and then playing live is like recess.
Mm-hmm.
You know. When you're out, you're just fucking going crazy, you know, and being more interactive human connection,
exactly.
You know, and all that. You're not hiding in a building with tapes rolling, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So live is my favorite thing because we have jams that we do and we don't really know what's going to happen with it, you know, depending on the reaction. We like to bring the crowd into the show. And it's different all the time, you know. It's just, however, you know, we just kind of feed off each other. It's like, you know, from when you're in a band, you do things like that.
Nice.
So it's not like cookie cutter.
Yeah, exactly.
Play everything exactly like the album. You know, we have little jams and, you know, get the crowd into it.
Super.
They can feel like a part of it.
Mark, so let us shift a couple of gears here and talk about your personality. And actually, you're living proof now that we're having this conversation that you're such a special, kind of person. So we heard through the grapevine that you define your way of thinking as old school. Okay, so what do you mean by that? So does it only apply to music or also to the interaction amongst human beings? Why old school?
Both. With music, I like to judge everything by my ears. Like, I like to listen to what we played back and trust my ears enough to say if it's good or bad. I don't want to judge by looking at a computer screen and seeing that, something's off a little bit and then fix that, because the whole thing about music is it's kind of an expression or whatever. And if it sounds good, then it is good to me. It's just good. If it sounds good, it's good. If you go by the computer saying it's not perfect or whatever, and you fix all that stuff, you're kind of turning it into a machine. You know what I mean? And that's what I'm kind of against. But, as far as life in general, modern technology makes everything go fast. The whole world has changed. But what I like about old school is how we had to go out and, do the footwork, go to high schools at 4 in the morning and put our flyers in lockers. I mean, we're creating memories. Those are my favorite times in the world, is going to Hollywood with a staple gun and putting up those flyers, man, on the telephone poles. And, just going to concerts, but not going to the concert, just putting our flyers in windshield wipers. We put up like 10,000 flyers just for a gig at a club in Hollywood, and also getting our name out. People seeing our name all over the place. So I kind of miss that, because if you're just in your phone and on the computer and you don't leave your house, you really don't have a lot to talk about in 20 years from now.
It's true.
It's like, well,
So true.
what happened? What happened? It's like, I have so many memories from my childhood, riding mini bikes, playing baseball, all that human connection, getting in trouble,
In real life, in real life.
just life stuff. So I like a lot about the modern technology, but I also like to hang out with people and talk to them in person and not texting. Texting, okay, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, when I say old school, I mean, we still get in a room and we jam. We don't like email each other our parts and, what do you think of that? When it's go time, we all sit together and go, what do you got?
Exactly.
Let's see what you got, bro.
When
And
should
I'll
be
play him
done?
a riff. I'll check this out, man. And they go, that sounds great. Let's work on that, And then we go in the practice room and we play. Because I think if you do everything technical and you send each other your parts, there's going to be a whole lot missing, because a lot stems from playing together
From being
that
there.
isn't not planned. It's not a planned thing. It happens because you're hanging out with your brothers and you're playing. Those accidents would have never happened if we were just sending your parts.
It is true. It
In
is
fact,
true.
it'd be interesting to hear a record done like that. I don't know. I guess it would sound like us, but I think a lot would be missing without that.
I think I know what the answer is going to be, but I still need to ask you, because you're such a well-established musician that with technology, and for instance with AI, okay, with artificial intelligence, do you think that AI will jeopardize creativity and soul when making music? Because now everybody can come up with an algorithm and create parts for a song, put them together, boom, out there on YouTube or anything or anywhere else. So what do you think about that?
Well, because of the way the world is now and all the mediums are gone, you know, with the no MTV, no radio playing new music, no record stores, everything is downloading. So you do have to kind of rethink, how are we going to release these 12 songs? Should it be two at a time? Should we just give them a video and a song, put it on Apple Music and wherever? The reason we continue to make music is for our own energy, you know? It's to keep being that painter that comes with a new painting, you know what I mean? We don't want to just be an oldies band that play these songs that you expect us to play, even though that's fine too, and we're grateful for that. It's like, but we still want to create music and go, what do you think of that? What do you think of this tune, dude? This is like one of the best things I've come up with for a while, you know what I mean? So we're always testing ourselves. We're testing ourselves to see if we can improve, you know, maybe we can do something better than what we've done before. And maybe the best song of our lives, even though it might not happen. But my dream is to write the best song I've ever written in my entire life and put it out there and use all these mediums. We have people that are like internet assassins that know how to get our music to the people pretty good.
Yeah.
But if you bombard people with, you know, 15 songs, and with the way the world is now, it's almost like too much info for the way they react to it. Because now it's the case, it's not like when we were kids and we knew everybody's name in Led Zeppelin and we read the liner notes and all that, you know, and we had that human connection with Ritchie Blackmore, you know. Today it's more like, download 40 songs before I go to school, maybe two from them, couple from that guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not like, you know, we're giving them this beautiful package with pictures and liner notes, and they know who the producer was and who wrote the songs. And, you know, it's just such a different world that we're almost thinking to go from the algorithms and all that and give them minimal information on what we feel that are best songs, and maybe a video, you know what I mean?
Yep.
Maybe go down that road.
Good take.
I want to talk about actual rock concerts, right? Because, for example, if you look at, you know, Kiss's End of the Road tour, everything is choreographed, right? Backing tracks, everything is in its place. Do you feel a show that is choreographed like that takes away from the music? It's more about show, less about music. Do you agree with that? What do you think?
I say to each his own. I'll speak for Great White. We don't do it, and it's never perfect, but that's just the way it is. You know, we like to sing without tapes. We just go out and play. That's why it's live. We're playing live, and it's not going to be perfect. But we're going to try to play good, you know. But as far as having things on tape or you know, playing, having music playing and playing to it or something, I don't even, I'm not technical enough to pull all that off, but we've never done it. There is one thing that we do, because Michael has to play acoustic guitar at the same time. He can't play keyboards too. So in Save Your Love, we have the keyboard on a, you know, like a click track.
Yeah, okay.
So we could have that only because we physically cannot.
You
do
can't
it.
Do it, right? Right.
You can't do it. You know, but we don't do anything to enhance our show or make it sound like, you know, like an album, as far as like on tape, like a bunch of guitar on tape or vocals.
It's
or
all about the music, you know, live music.
But we practice our vocals. We practice backstage every night before a gig. We practice our harmonies and make sure everybody's voice is sounding right. And,
nice.
You know, go out there and try to hit those notes.
So, you know, longevity really is a, it really says something about a band, that a band can last 30, 40, 50 years. They're doing something right. And obviously, Great White is doing something right, has done something right. You guys have been around for so long. What are some of your accomplishments from the past few years, maybe 10, 15 years?
We haven't made a new record for a while, but I've been writing like crazy. And our bass player just had surgery. And as soon as that's over, we're getting together and we're getting something out this year without fail.
Nice.
So new music this year. As far as accomplishments, you know, it's just the smaller goals. It's playing our best shows, staying healthy, trying to treat ourselves well. You know, we're not youngsters anymore. So, you know, we got to treat ourselves well. And, but it, as far as any kind of trophies or, we haven't been nominated for a Grammy lately. Haven't sold a million records in a while. One thing that happened, I was really surprised, a few years ago, one of our greatest hits went gold.
Oh, really?
Which,
oh, nice.
Which kind of shocked me in a way, because people don't really buy records anymore. You know what I mean? They download songs. So
yeah, fortunately,
for it to go gold, it was like, it kind of blew my mind. And but, you know, I think our era, like in the 90s, it kind of got put on the back burner a little bit. But when people discover it, even the 20-somethings, and they weren't really familiar because they weren't around at the time, they're going, man, this stuff's badass.
Yeah.
I've seen it firsthand. Guys, 20 years old. I've told the story before, but I went out in front of a hotel in Sweden. We were playing with, like, Udo, you know, Accept and Zebra and stuff like that. They were playing this like mini festival, if you will. And these kids, I'm not kidding, they were like 20 years old. And they were wearing clothes, literally, that I wore in 1985. I'm like, they're like all about the 80s. I mean, they just love the music. They're going, this stuff, like they discovered something new. You know what I mean? And when that happens, it makes me feel amazing, because that we're reaching a generations away from when we were there.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a 20-year-old loving our music, it to me is like really a great accomplishment.
Of course.
You know,
of course.
Not by design, but you know what I'm saying? It makes you feel good that some guy that didn't even, not even familiar with you, hear stuff for the first time and goes, man, that stuff's awesome. I love this. You know, that's pretty cool. That's good stuff. And they say, my parents aren't that corny. You
know? That's the proof. That's like, right.
Literally, at least this stuff rocks. You know? So that's what it is.
Mark, when you're not in the recording studio or on stage with Great White, so what are some of the projects that you're involved in? So what have you been doing lately?
Well, I'm a sober advocate. I work with a lot of different entities that, you know, get people into rehab through grants and raising money for this and that. And I do a lot of charity work and speak at meetings. As far as recreational, I play pool. I'm kind of a pool player. Actually played in the world championships in New York, but it's been a while. It was 2018, I believe.
Okay.
And actually, I won a couple matches, but, I have a lot of respect for the game. These guys play, 8 hours a day. It's all they do is play pool. So, I can't figure to play part time on the weekends and I'm a guitar player and go just mow these people down. they're just way too good. Yeah. But I enjoy that.
Do you follow any sports?
I like
you're a sports fan.
Hanging
right?
out. Well, I played baseball until I was 18.
Okay.
I from 8 years old to 18, my dad was my coach every year. He wanted me to be a pro. By the time I was 18, I was kind of a little bit disheartened because, for one thing, if you're going to have somebody scout you, your numbers have to be above the entire league. Mm-hmm. You're getting write-ups every week. I was third best on my own team out of like 10 teams. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they're not going to go, hey, where's that third best guy? We want him on the Dodgers.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had two guys on my own team. They threw harder, ran faster, hit more home runs, had better girlfriends.
You can't do it all, right?
I had no chance. No chance. So I went full-time music. Right before I turned 18, I went full-time music, dedicated myself fully.
And you did great.
Because from 15 to 18, I was playing guitar every day. I mean, I literally would not leave my guitar from 15 to 18. That's where I really got on a level to where I could be in a band. I felt that I could play with people and be in a band.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of dedication and effort, there you go. You got it.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. I loved it for one thing. So that helped me improve because I wanted to get better. And literally, I would actually go to the store and bring my acoustic because I didn't want to leave it for like 15 minutes.
Really?
I mean, I'd look like a goof walking down the street with my acoustic, but I didn't even care. I'm playing I'm Going Home note for note by Alvin Lee 10 years after while walking on the sidewalk. I mean, that's like goofy. I would go play poker with these guys and bring my acoustic in between hands. I'm playing like Santana.
Seriously.
I mean, I'm Can't literally stop. Playing poker while playing my guitar. So that's how crazy it was.
Well, Mark, before we close the curtain on the show, we often talk about, dedicated Kiss fans, the Kiss Army. It was the fans that got Kiss to where they are today. What do you want to say about Great White fans?
Well, one thing I can say is they, and I'm not just saying it because I'm in Great White, they're so loyal. They love the music so much. And I'm talking about worldwide, like Europe. I have so many fans get a hold of me on Facebook. They chime in all the time. They are deep cuts, not just the rock muse and Lady Red Light and all that.
Mm.
They like songs that have never been on the radio. They talk about stuff that only hardcore fans discover about your band because they're so close to all the music that they love music that it's like would be considered a filler almost, mm-hmm. A song that's maybe not a hit that's going to get a lot of attention. So I love that. I mean, it's not an army. I remember the Kiss Army and all that, which is just a great idea. But we have our own Great White Army, and they're just the most dedicated, loyal fans. And now at the age we are now, they still come to the shows. There's a wider range group of ages, but they're still there. And I think they come down to just relive their
memories.
Because we grew up with our fans. You have to realize we grew up with our fans.
Right.
So here we are. We're still here. They're still fans. They're not going to like, okay, I don't like music anymore. I mean, they still love it. And I love that. And we've always treated our fans with, I mean, total love. I mean, these are our friends. These are people we grew up with. You know, fine, they call it fans, you know, whatever. They're more than that, than a fan to me. They're friends. I recognize faces all the time at shows. Mm-hmm. You know, we have memories. We used to have a guy, we didn't even know how he got into our concert. And he must have went to like 30 shows in a row. And he's in the front row every night.
Really?
By sneaking in somehow. We didn't even like, we thought it was the greatest thing ever. Well, how do you do that, dude? And he would sing like Mr. Bone. We'd let him sing, you know. And his name was Crazy Mark. So we have fans like that that are just, they'll do anything to get in a show. And just wonderful memories with the fans. And they're still here, which is great.
Fantastic. Mark, you know, we can't thank you enough. You know, it's been truly an honor to have you in the show. It's been so enriching. And, you know, in my case, I learned so much about, you know, Great White and what you guys were doing over the years. So highly appreciate it. You know, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks for having me on the show, man. Thanks for all you guys do. Keep the music alive.
Oh, thank you so much. And I got to say, you know, we've talked about, you know, your hard work, your success, all of your accomplishments, and, you know, the overnight success thing. That's all true. But you know what? No matter how good the music, how hard the work, it's the person that makes it happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could attribute your success to the person that you are. And you are an amazing person.
Thank you.
You deserve everything that's happened to you, and so happy of all of your accomplishments. Just fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
So, to the KISS Army, we hope you enjoyed this episode. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas, please send them to talktome@kissarmynationpodcast.com. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Please support our amazing guests. Until the next time, remember, never stop rocking. Take care, everyone. If you enjoyed this episode, like and subscribe on YouTube or follow us on Spotify, Podomatic, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Don't forget to make yourself heard. Leave us a comment on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. See you all soon, KISS Army.